You're listening to a program created at IONS, the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Thank you for supporting our research in consciousness and its practical applications for education, healthcare, and a more sustainable world. For more information, visit us at www.noetic.org.
Welcome to the Essentials of Noetic Sciences series. I'm Lindsay King, and tonight our host is ION's Director of Research, Cassandra Beaton, and she will introduce her guest, Daniel Siegel. Welcome, Cassie.
Hi there, and thank you for coming on, all of you who called, and thank you so much, Dan, for agreeing to join us for this interview.
Pleasure.
Dan Siegel is a professor at UCLA, and he's the author of several books and articles. One of my favorites is Parenting from the Inside Out, and one of the most recent books is MindSight, The New Science of Personal Transformation. And Dan has become, over the years, a supporter, a friend, a colleague, a virtual mentor, and I'm just thrilled to be able to talk to you this evening, Dan.
Well, thanks. It's great to be here, Cassie.
So let me just jump right in, and can you explain what is MindSight?
Well, MindSight is a term that saved my life when I was in medical school. It was kind of a inner word I used to use to talk about professors that I had who could see the mind of patients and treat them with dignity. And when it was absent, there were professors who I had to say to myself, oh, that person doesn't have MindSight, so be careful because they're not a good role model. And I'd actually dropped out of medical school and then ultimately came back trying to understand how so much of what was happening for me and my colleagues in school was a kind of socialization to not see the mind as something real in our patients or even in ourselves. So that's how the word first got started. But when I became a psychiatry trainee a few years later, I started using that word in my own head to mean how we see the mind of ourselves or others. So MindSight is literally the ability to see the mind in oneself or in others. And ultimately, it's gotten a larger meaning having to do with all sorts of things about the brain and about our relationships that we can talk about. But that's sort of how the word began, as a way of just realizing people have this perceptual ability and some actually don't have it very well developed.
And I think that it seems like some people really have it naturally, and for others, they remain sort of mind blind their whole lives. And others have a little inkling, and then there's a way of training MindSight. Can you talk a little bit more about how someone trains this capacity in themselves or in other people?
Absolutely. Well, I think one of the most illuminating studies was on kids who are deaf, who cannot hear. And those deaf kids who have parents who are really sophisticated at using sign language had this ability, which in the research terminology is called theory of mind. They could actually imagine that other people have a mind. But deaf kids who were raised by parents who were just learning how to sign because perhaps they themselves weren't deaf or they hadn't learned this ability to communicate, their kids actually had an impairment in theory of mind, similar to kids with autism, in fact, who also are impaired in this way. And what that taught us was that the use of language to embed terms like feelings and thoughts and what were you hoping for and looking into or perceptions, memories, what do you recall, those kinds of words that we share with each other, especially with kids when they're growing up, those are the kinds of symbols we use in communication to help people develop this MindSight ability, this capacity to know that you have a mind and I have a mind. And so we know that relationally you can stimulate this set of circuits in the brain, really, to grow in childhood. And even in adulthood, if someone wasn't fortunate enough to have that ability taught to them early on, you can actually teach it to them in many cases. In some cases, like an autism, where it's not caused by experiential lack, it may be not so easy to teach, if in fact sometimes not even possible, because the circuitry really isn't there. But in many, many cases of people who haven't had the opportunity to learn it, it's a very teachable skill. And the great news is that once you teach it, people can begin to develop well-being inside of themselves and also improve relationships with other people, as you can imagine.
I know you've had an interest in how meditation and contemplative practices are one pathway toward training a kind of mind sight. Can you say more about your interest in those and how you think that is related to the development of mind sight?
Yeah, it's a real, you know, it's a very, I'm saying yeah because I just came from Australia, and for some reason they don't say yes. Yes, I can respond to that, Cassie. You know, part of what happened in my journey was, in medical school back in the late 70s, you know, not having this mindset being taught to me by my professors of medicine was really, really discouraging. And then in psychiatry, wanting to use this knowledge that seeing the mind was really important in clinical care led me to really explore that more in the field of attachment research, studying how parents and children interact and looking at how the mind develops this ability to what Peter Fonagy and other researchers call reflect or reflective function that allows you to mentalize. That's that research term. And so for me as an attachment-trained research person, also working as a therapist, these were very important parts of developing a healthy mind from a relational point of view. And when I wrote The Developing Mind, it was to kind of look at the science underneath mindsight, this ability to reflect on the internal nature of the mind. When I translated that book into that book you mentioned, Parenting from the Inside Out, we use the term mindfulness, meaning being intentional, be mindful in your parenting. But then I learned that there was this whole field of mindfulness meditation, which I was unfamiliar with, and that's how I got to know Jon Kabat-Zinn and Jack Kornfield and others who were in this mindfulness world, and I was literally unaware of the not only deep contemplative practice over thousands of years, but also not informed yet of all the science that was emerging in looking at mindfulness. So over the last 5 years, a lot of what I've been doing in my writings is to try to look at the overlap of a number of different ways of knowing, whether it's in contemplative practice or attachment or psychotherapy or, the arts or whatever. So one of those branches is in the field of mindfulness, and what I see is that mindfulness is a way of, it's many, many, many things, and in fact it doesn't really have a fixed definition, but one way of understanding mindfulness meditation is the idea is it encourages people to look inward at their own inner experience, to go beyond words and thoughts and to get with sensations and the experiential aspect of life, and in doing so, kind of become clearer in the moment about what's actually going on with yourself, letting go of expectations and judgments. And in that way, the practice of mindfulness meditation is a direct way of developing one aspect of the mindsight skill, which is to see the subjective inner world. It's also, it turns out, really useful for developing empathic relationships, which is another part of what we look at in mindsight. We actually look at the compassion and empathy that's fundamental to healthy relationships. And the third thing that we look at is an integrated brain. And I believe even though mindfulness doesn't try to achieve integration in the brain, the linking of differentiated parts, in mindsight we actually use that as the third thing we look at is how you use the focus of attention to actually integrate the brain. And I think mindfulness as a form of meditative practice is an extremely integrative process. So you can see that the regions of the brain that link widely separated areas to each other are those that are stimulated in their activation during meditation and then seem, and there's a preliminary evidence to suggest they seem to be able to grow with the practice of meditation. And integrative fibers are those fibers that are regulatory. So the bottom line of all that is, from a mindset point of view, we're so excited to learn about this ancient practice of mindfulness meditation because we see it as a profoundly integrative one where you develop this close attunement internally and interpersonally. So it's integrative all around. So we're very excited to actually embrace all these new findings from the practice of mindfulness.
Yeah, and it seems so interesting that what seems to be such a personal introspective practice that has really most often been practiced in a solitary fashion where someone is maybe sitting on a cushion observing their own experience, in fact, at the same time is helping you to connect with other people, and it sort of almost seems like a beneficial side effect of being able to observe your own experience somehow automatically allows you to be more aware of other people's experience or take their perspective.
Well, exactly. And that's, you know, that's the amazing thing about it. And, you know, in the field I work in, which is called interpersonal neurobiology, you know, we have this way of kind of trying to embrace all the different ways of knowing about the truth. And so one time I was with 40 neurologists at a retreat in Santa Barbara at the mission there. And so we were just doing the basic kind of concentration form of meditation, which is shamatha. And what was amazing was that in the fifth day of the seven-day retreat, two of the neurologists, the neuroscientists were there, they both had the same observation that in one case their fiancé, in the other case their spouse, said, what's going on with you? You've become so empathic. You're so open to me now. You've never been like this. And all we were doing was doing breath awareness practice for 5 days. But when you look at the circuitry of the brain that's activated during a simple breath awareness practice, which is simple, but as you know, not easy, you're actually stimulating the neural firing of areas of the brain that allow you to tune into your own internal state. And when you look at the studies of empathy, it's those exact same circuits that we use to tune into ourselves that we also use to tune into another person's inner world through a system of neurons called the mirror neurons. And so what's so exciting then is when you look at the neural circuitry that these mental activities are kind of using to create themselves, then what happens is you can understand why an internal practice of attunement would naturally lend itself to making more interpersonal attunement, which is what empathy is all about. So once you know the mechanisms beneath it, it stops being so magical, but it's still wonderful.
And Dan, how do you define mind? What, when you say mind, I know that it includes a lot more than maybe what people think, which is thoughts. What is mind?
Yes, well, you know, Cassie, this is the funniest thing, and I'm going to go give grand rounds tomorrow at Stanford, and that's that's the title of my grand rounds talk. And it's a funny thing because, you know, I've now interviewed 94,500 mental health practitioners all around the world. I just did a national tour through Australia, and I've taught in Europe and Asia and everywhere. And whatever anyone's profession is, whether it's psychiatry or psychology or, you know, social work or nursing or occupational therapy, you can go through the whole list of our team of mental health workers. The number has been the same. It's about 2 to 5% say they've ever had a lecture even that defined what the mind is. And even in the mental health part, of course, there's just saying, well, you know, we have all these disorders that are important to try to reduce, but we don't have a framework for health, you know, a healthy mind. So the way I use an operational definition of at least a part of what the mind is, not the whole of the mind. Of course, the mind's a mystery, and it's full of consciousness and the incredible majesty of the feeling of red and the feeling of love and of music and all that that's our subjective inner life. But those are all parts of the mind. But one core aspect of the mind that has been useful from a think tank I ran about, 1992, so a long time ago, that helped scientists actually communicate each other with is this definition, that the mind is really an emergent property, something that arises in the interaction of our neural system and our relational system. And these are two systems that allow energy and information to flow, both like right now between me and you and everyone listening on the line. So we have energy and information that's passing between us, but also energy and information passes through the nervous system. And so the mind can be seen as an emergent property. And where is it arising? It's arising in an embodied way, so not just in the skull, not just the brain in the skull, but the whole nervous system or the whole body, really, an embodied way. And it's also relational, and it's an embodied and relational process, this emergent property, that regulates the flow of energy and information. And with this definition, 40 scientists that I invited to address the question of how the mind and brain connected to each other, we could meet for 4.5 years and really discuss in a very open way this connection between mind and brain. And with this definition, too, you can realize how relationships, let's say, a child has in a family deeply affect the way neurons get connected to each other, or the way your neurons are connected to each other by experience or genes affect how your relationships emerge. And both relationships and your neural structure influence mental experience. So with this definition, you're really covering a wide area. And the other thing that's great about this definition and so useful in terms of being something you can apply in clinical work or educational work or parenting work is that you can teach people how to regulate with more clarity and specificity by teaching them to do the two things that are in regulation. One is monitoring, like when you drive a car, you have to watch where you're going. And the other is modulating or modifying, like turn the steering wheel, put on the brakes, and accelerate. You can teach people to monitor with more clarity and depth so that you can see more detail that's stabilized. And you can teach them to monitor so that you can then modify, once you see the details, in a way that moves the system toward integration. So in the work that we do in this mindsight approach, it's really embracing a definition of mind as part of what the mind is, and then saying, here we can define what a healthy mind is. A healthy mind, then, is something that moves you toward integration, which is a harmonious flow bounded on either side by chaos or rigidity. So anyway, that's the whole thing in a nutshell, but the details are wonderful because what you see is that you can start predicting what future research might show, and that's really exciting to find those things coming true as technology advances. And you can use it with individuals in schools and in psychotherapy or in parenting so that you can actually see people growing in an integrative way, which is basically synonymous with health and resilience. That's a long answer to a short question.
it's good. And I'm, you know, one of our researchers, Dean Radin, has a book called Entangled Minds, which has a lot of stuff in it. But this kind of idea of entanglement between minds, particularly in families, but also in relationships and perhaps even in our communities, may have a neurobiological basis. It's not that we have these minds that are just sort of encapsulated inside of our skulls, but they also extend into our bodies and they extend into our relationships. And there's some place where our minds meet and interact with one another. Well, what is, you know, you talked about the future of science, and I'm just curious, what is sort of new and hot and interesting for you? What are your next steps?
Well, you know, one thing that we've been doing here at the MindSight Institute is, you know, providing an online presence. So we have people on 6 continents in fields of education and parenting and psychotherapy. Those are our main people that we work with. And what we're finding is that there's a global community that's growing, applying these principles of really interpersonal neurobiology in these various settings. And so what my hope is for the scientific application side of this is to see that people can find the practical use of a definition of the mind, of a definition of health as integration, and the practical steps, there are these 9 domains of integration you can work within, practical steps that people can take to actually promote a stronger, healthier, more resilient mind in schools and in families, and to also use those principles in psychotherapy. So that's on the practical application side, that's what we've been finding. On the scientific side, you know, we now have 24 books, most of them already out actually in the public, in the series on interpersonal neurobiology. So we're really trying to weave together what's called a consilient approach of combining many different sciences together into this field that we call interpersonal neurobiology, which, by the way, is different from social neuroscience. We're a field that looks at all the different ways of knowing and puts them into one scientifically grounded perspective that's not just a branch of neurobiology. So the name is kind of misleading in a way. And so what I did this summer, which was really, from a scientific point of view, incredibly rewarding, was I had 15 interns work with me, and we were revising The Developing Mind, which came out in 1999. And I gave them the task, you know, prove that this book and its hypotheses are wrong. And so we projected the book up on the wall. They had 3 months to go over all the scientific literature they could find to try to prove that the book was wrong. And I'm happy to report that we found 1,700 new scientific papers out in the last, 11 years that support this basic hypothesis that you can work with the concept of health as integration, and you can predict, as some of the studies, for example, that Marcus Raichel's lab shows, that this default mode state of the resting state that the brain's in, for example, when you're not given a task, when it's linking differentiated parts, which we just call integration for short, when it's linking differentiated parts, it's healthy. And in various conditions of unhealth, like schizophrenia or autism, there's impairments to integration. And so that and other findings, for example, in abuse, in the developing mind, it predicted that, abuse, child abuse would be associated with impaired integrative growth of the brain. And in the subsequent years now, there's a lot of data to support that hypothesis, not to prove it, but to support it. And that the process of psychotherapy is ultimately a process of harnessing this function of neuroplasticity that is using the focus of attention as an experience that changes the structural connections in the brain. And we see it as not just changing the brain, but actually integrating the brain. And so that's been exciting. And then finally, there's this amazing thing that it's hard to even say without getting too excited about it. When you look at the DSM, the whole book is an example of chaos, rigidity, or both. And so that's predicted by the scientific exploration of integration leading to harmony, and impaired integration, impaired linkage or differentiation leading to chaos or rigidity. And so that's consistent. And so what we're trying to do now is make projections of what future technology will show, that various forms of psychiatric disorders will be seen, whether it's experientially induced or genetically induced vulnerabilities, as examples of impaired integration, and that new forms of psychotherapy can be scientifically tested that are specifically trying to integrate the brain through the power of empathic relationships. And really, empathic relationships are integrative ones, and you can use these very specific techniques. I talk about this in the MindSight book and the Mindful Therapist book, but where you snag the brain, you stimulate neuronal activation and growth, kind of like using attention for a therapist like a surgeon uses a scalpel. You're very specific in where you're focusing attention to integrate the brain. So those are many of the scientific things that, we're really excited about in the future, to lay a broad framework of health, define the mind or offer a working definition of the mind, and then see if we can find new ways to use the mind to make the brain stronger and relationships more empathic, basically to bring more kindness into the world, more kindness and health.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like in many fields that we're moving from sort of this laser-sharp focus on, say, a particular symptom or a particular part of the brain or a particular disorder, and now it seems in many fields that we're learning that it's not so much exactly what symptom you have or exactly which part of the brain is lighting up. It has more to do with the systems approach to what's happening with an individual, what's happening in a family, what's happening in a community or in a culture. And it seems like interesting. I've worked with clients, and it's a lovely thing to do to say, okay, so rather than honing in on this one symptom you have and trying to reduce it, because we know that in a systems perspective that just means another one might pop up somewhere else, mm-hmm. that we're looking at greater integration, greater cohesiveness, and really greater relationality in the ways that we're approaching these issues that are really important to everyone. And I'm wondering, you talked about several practical steps that people can take, and one we talked about was mindfulness. Do you have a couple of others that you could talk about?
Sure. Well, first of all, let me just say, Kathy, that what you were saying is so eloquent and eloquent. It's so beautifully said. And when you start looking at energy and information flow patterns, in it from a systems point of view, then you can go from societies to synapses. you can really look deeply across the spectrum of our human experience and honor all the incredible research people have done on synaptic connections and neurotransmitters and the way the nervous system works literally as a system. But realize that's a very important way of looking at things, as important as looking at societies and the way we function in cultures. And what they share in common is energy and information flow patterns. So in terms of what people can do, one of the things that we talk about is the idea that if you try on this definition of the mind or as part of what the mind is in your own personal life and say, okay, well, if I'm really defining the mind as this embodied and relational process, I need to honor my body and be tuned into my body. So any kind of mindfulness practice that allows you to do that, any kind of body scan, yoga, really being in touch with your body is very, very important. Then we say the relational part. Well, then you say, look, our minds are totally interconnected. You know, you can look at the fabulous work done on social networks in Boston, in Chicago. There's some fantastic writings being done about how amazingly interconnected we are. You mentioned your author and your group, too, that this is not just, you know, some soft thing. This is not that it has to be scientifically proven to be hard, but this is scientifically established reality that our mental lives are profoundly interconnected with one another. And that's not just opinion, that's scientifically proven fact. So when you view it like that, then you got to pull yourself out of the ways of thinking just in small ways and say, okay, well, if I'm relational, then what do I do with that? Well, then what you do is you look at your ability to, now here's the regulation part. You say, what do you do? If you do something in your life to start, number one, monitoring energy and information flow inside your body in a new way, even if you start this tonight, you know, focus on your breath. That's the mindfulness piece. But even more than that, just see if you can start being open to thoughts, feelings, images, sensations, memories, all the elements of our mental lives as energy patterns. Just try that as a monitoring thing. And then instead of just doing it within yourself, now when you're speaking with someone you're close to or a neighbor, someone you work with, try just noticing how you're taking in their internal world, how you're really allowing yourself to resonate with that person. And here what we're doing in terms of a first step is you're opening up your monitoring ability, this mindsight way of thinking about it, in your body and in your relationships, but seeing them as actually part of the same system of energy and information flow, not different, but just part of where awareness can take you. There's lots of trainings you can do. There's a even on my website, you can just stream this thing of the Wheel of Awareness, where there's a formalized practice that it was intended to be what's called integration of consciousness. It allows you to feel the centrality of a hub of awareness and anything you can be aware of on the rim. And it allows you actually to deepen your monitoring capacity. And I can tell you, when I was in Australia, for example, I taught this, you know, it's like a 25-minute practice, and a couple of people who had severe chronic pain, I'm talking about over years, came up to me at the break after we did this practice, and they go, I don't know what happened, but I've had pain for 3-4 years. I've never been pain-free, and now I don't have the pain. What did you do? And I said, well, it's not what I did. You integrated your awareness, and you put the pain in its proper place on the rim, and you strengthened your hub so that you found a way to actually differentiate these elements of the rim, in this case like body pain, from the fullness of awareness. And in doing that, you've liberated yourself from the prison that the pain had you in. And, you know, this has happened not just in Australia, but where you have to be upside down or something, but, you know, this has happened so many times. So the Wheel of Awareness is a practice that if you said, can I do one thing to learn to monitor in an integrative way, I would say do that. And at my website, you can stream it and listen to it and stuff like that. The second thing I would just say in terms of the modifying part of what people can do, even if you just begin with the integration of consciousness, you can show that once you differentiate this rim element from the hub where awareness is, you start to enter a process whereby you can start to modify exactly what's going on with you. And I've had people with severe anxiety, for example, where just doing this Wheel of Awareness practice, it kind of melts away. It's almost weird how quickly it works. But for many people, it's worked very powerfully. And then you can go through these other domains, like, for example, learning about what the left and right hemisphere are like, and if you, in your personal life, haven't found a way to link those two areas together, or if one has not been differentiated. And, you know, if we had more time, I could go through exactly what that would mean. But you can actually, like I saw a new person today, and he really was struggling with being aware of his body. He had struggled with aware of autobiographical memory. He had trouble reducing his anxiety. Those functions, autobiographical memory, a map of the whole body, and reduction of stress, stress modulation, those are all right hemisphere specialties. They're shared by both hemispheres, but they're really dominant in the right. And for various reasons in his childhood, you know, he really had a hard time developing those skills as a kid. And now, in the work you can do even on your own, you can take these mindset skills, like integrating left and right. And in his case, he's going to need to develop more of a right hemisphere capacity before he then links the two. But you can go through all these. There's up and down. There's up, memory integration. There's all these steps that have a kind of background to them. But once you get the general notion of how to master this idea of integration is health, the mind is embodied in relational process that can move the system of energy and information flow toward integration, then the wonderful thing is it's an empowerment of the individual, even independent of therapy, but the empowerment of the individual within your own bodily life and relational life to promote integration and health. So there's lots of things to do. Those are just, the wheel is just one. If I had to say start with anything, I would say starting with that integration of consciousness would be a really good place to begin.
Yeah, I mean, I just love that wheel of awareness. I'm going to have to go back to your website and look at that. And one of the metaphors we've used in our research on transformation is that of a map, where it's really where you're relocating yourself. So it may not be that the circumstances of your life are different. It may not even be so much that the circumstances of your being or mind or feelings or body pain are different. It's that you're locating yourself in a different place. And when we use this map metaphor, we say, you know, rather than maybe locating yourself in the center of the pain, you're locating yourself in a different part of the map. And then eventually you find out that you're holding the map. You know, you're actually the one that's holding the map, and that way you can integrate all of the different aspects. And I talked to Zindel Siegel this last weekend when I was at a conference, and I always remember this thing that he told me about a client he was working with who was depressed and was learning a mindfulness practice. And he said, okay, so how's this working on your depression? And she said, well, I'm still depressed. I'm just not letting it make me miserable anymore.
Yeah, that's great. That's exactly right. That's the beautiful thing, you know, and you talk about that even in your book, you know, about the power of parents to remain clear and calm, you know, which is so beautiful. It's just great.
Yeah. I mean, I think that mindfulness and the other aspects that you're talking about can be transmitted. And, well, I think this would be a great time to open the conversation to people who are listening who might have questions for you.
I'd be happy to. Thanks, Cassie. This is wonderful to have this conversation with you.
Yeah.
Okay, great. If you'd like to ask a question of our guest, Daniel Siegel, or host, Cassandra Beaton, simply press 1 on your phone keypad now. And it wouldn't hurt to press it a couple times, because sometimes it doesn't come through the first time. So we will start with Peter. Peter, go ahead. You have the mic.
Oh, hey, Cassie. So I think you can probably ask this question better than I can, but I'm interested in acceptance and how that connects with mindfulness, and then integrating these two concepts.
So integrating the concept of acceptance and mindfulness?
Yeah, understanding some of the distinctions between the two of them.
Mm.
Sometimes people talk about acceptance as being a part of mindfulness, and I'm curious what your understanding of that is.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a great question, and when I've been looking into literature or talking to people in the field, you know, the word mindfulness is used in different ways by different people. So I think you're absolutely right. In some cases, they're just overlapping ideas. That is, mindfulness is a state of mind of being aware in the present moment of experience as it unfolds without having judgments and accepting things exactly as they are. So in that perspective, you know, acceptance is built into what is meant by mindfulness. If you look at some of the work of Ruth Baer and her colleagues in Kentucky, looking at these factors of mindful traits, one of them is being non-judgmental, which is not laying on judgments of things. And the others are, you know, being aware of things as they occur, acting with awareness is what it's called, being non-reactive, not being explosive and emotionally, or if you do, you return to baseline. And then there's an interesting one, you know, being able to label and describe the internal world, which isn't exactly acceptance, but it's kind of at least sort of naming it to tame it. And then a fifth one, which is found in people who've been trained as meditators as a separate, that is an autonomous finding, is self-observation. So they don't really use the word acceptance in Ruth Baer's thing, but it's kind of woven a little bit into the non-judgmental viewpoint. So even in there, in terms of traits, not just like a state, as some people talk about in terms of being in a mindful state, if there's any such thing. So some people use it as built into mindfulness in these ways. Other people, you know, Tara Brach, of course, writes about radical acceptance, and, you know, but I don't think they're incompatible, and I think it really just depends on, you know, who you speak to, as is the case, for example, with self-compassion. I mean, the beautiful work on self-compassion by a number of people, including Paul Gilbert, you know, looks at this way of accepting yourself as you are. And so they use the term self-compassion, and it involves, you know, the sense that you're a part of an unfolding journey through the course of humanity. And so in all these ways, I think, you know, we can look at acceptance as sort of built into all of that.
And I would just add to that that I think acceptance is the word that has been used most often to translate this concept of meeting things as they are. And another definition for mindfulness is seeing clearly, which really kind of fits in with your mindsight conceptualization, where acceptance isn't that you approve of something or condone it or say, this is fine, I'm happy with this, I'm fine. It's not this resigned sort of feeling or defeat. But it's really saying that this is what is happening right now. And mindsight, I think, in a way, if you allow me to elaborate, Dan, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, has to do with just meeting yourself and meeting the other person with a clear sight, with an accurate vision, with an accurate sight of what's happening, rather than so much projection or storytelling or, you know, boy, this is how I wish it would be or this is how I wish it wasn't. And that, I think, is really what acceptance is trying to get at in the mindfulness literature. It's a little bit of an unfortunate translation of what acceptance really means, because I think in our culture it kind of means, well, I accept it, that means it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
What it really means is this is what is.
Clearly,
I see what's happening. I see it clearly. Yeah,
I think that's great. And, the way we kind of operationalize that in the mindsight world is we imagine a kind of camera that's stabilized by a tripod, and the tripod has three legs, so it allows you to see clearly because you're stabilizing this kind of mindsight camera. And one of them is observation, which is the ability to kind of see things as if you're an observer. The other is objectivity, which is, you know, you don't get swept up into something. You allow it to be kind of an object of observation, if you will. But the other is openness, and the openness is pure acceptance. It's the idea of being open to what is, just like Cassie's talking about it, so that, you know, acceptance, translated as openness, is a fundamental part of stabilizing the lens, because without it, you are projecting, you are putting judgments on, and once you start doing that, you start distorting what you see through what you expect, and that's where you become a prisoner of your own perceptual distortions. So acceptance is then fundamental to mindsight, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Oh, okay, you're welcome.
Thank you, Peter. Okay, next we will hear from DS. Go ahead, DS, you have the mic. Did you want to ask a question, Mr. DS Hargis?
Can you hear me?
Yes, Yes, go right ahead.
Okay. You know, I submitted my question by email. Let's see if I can remember it. It was really asking the question. Can you still hear me? I'm sorry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. It was asking the question of to the doctor if when one is really finds himself in a state of being immersed in a lot of stress chemicals such as ACTH and cortisol and some of the other stress chemicals, along with low serotonin levels and low endorphins, if he felt that that was a real impediment to someone being able to achieve either a higher state of consciousness or God consciousness, or I think I'm just wondering about a raised consciousness and the link between that and our actual neurochemistry.
Yeah, what a beautiful question and a difficult one. You know, one way I've heard of trying to address that important question is this, that you have the notion that there's soil and then there's seed. And processes like mindfulness meditation or prayer are the seed that you need to plant in the proper soil. So if you have severe stress with high, you know, cortisol and ACTH, or low other things that you need, even low omega-3s to keep the membranes working well, omega-3 fatty acids that we really need to keep the neural system functioning well. If the soil is arid, if it doesn't have a lot of nutrients, if it isn't supportive of the seed growing, then no matter the kind of meditative practice, prayer practice we do, it may be limited because the soil isn't fertile. And so what you'd want to do then is make sure one is doing the many different things that are possible, proper nutrition, proper working out of lifestyle so that stress is reduced if that's possible. Aerobic exercise is really important. Having healthy sources of omega-3s. All these things are very important to make sure the soil is really as healthy as can be so that when you do plant the seeds of a focus of attention, you can achieve these healthy states of awareness. So I think it's very important. And, you know, I think the studies by Zindel Siegel and others that show that if you're severely depressed, that mindfulness by itself is not helpful to pull you out of the depression in severe cases. That's what their study was able to show. And, in fact, it only helps avoid recurrence of depression if you've had three or more severe bouts of depression. So sometimes, you know, the soil is so in a condition that it cannot provide the seeds an environment to grow in. We really need to do the things that are necessary before the seed can really start to grow. So, yes, I think you really need to take care of those things, and sometimes they do, in fact, limit it. The second part of your question is, you know, what are the relationship between these two? And that's just absolutely fascinating, you know, how the neural functioning affects this amazing thing called awareness. How does that happen? And, you know, that could be a whole other hour we could do. And, you know, certainly, you know, we talk about it all the time over here at the Mindset Institute. But, you know, what is the connection between neural firing and the subjective experience of being aware and then all the different ways you can be conscious of different things? And that's just absolutely fascinating and, you know, worthy of a whole hour unto itself.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, DS. Okay, now we will take a call from Shankar. Shankar, go ahead. You have the mic.
Hi. Thank you. Dan, I want to ask a question. What is your experience about mindfulness and business?
Mindfulness and business?
Mindset and business. The application of mindset into the business world.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are people much more experienced than I am at mindfulness who are teaching, various forms of mindfulness practice in the business world. Jon Kabat-Zinn, for one, does, you know, all sorts of conferences in that realm. Dan Goleman does that. David Rock is from the business side doing that kind of thing. I do have people working with Mindsight, so I can speak a little bit more about that, using the Wheel of Awareness in business and things like that. And the feedback we've gotten has been really excellent in terms of teaching business students and people in corporations. But we're just beginning in that field. We just published our first paper through the Journal of Neuroleadership on applying the principles of interpersonal neurobiology to the organizational environment. And if you go to the Neuroleadership Journal from about a year ago, you'll find that article that I did with a colleague. Deborah Pierce McCall was my co-author on that one. And there you'll see using mindset principles in the business world. But the other people I mentioned would know a lot more than I do about how do you actually teach mindfulness in the business environment.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Shankar. And again, if you would like to ask a question, please press 1 on your keypad. And a few minutes ago when people pressed 1, we do seem to have lost some of them on our screen for whatever reason. So if you had pressed 1 before and you haven't been called on yet, please press 1 again so we can make sure that we get you. Okay, and I'll read a question that was emailed into us.
Sure.
This is from Dan. And he says, when new neural pathways are developed by virtue of new behavior patterns, do older pathways deteriorate, or do they remain equally at the ready to kick in if the new behavior is not initiated?
Well, this is a wonderful question about a very important issue. My research mentor in memory, Bob Bjork, used to have a statement that he would tell us that memory retrieval can be a memory modifier. And what that means is the act of retrieval and then reflecting on the thing that's being retrieved can alter the component that's being brought back into memory, into awareness. Now, from a training point of view, what Bob Bjork has really taught us is that you really need to do two things, and this really addresses the question. One is you do learn new skills. So developing memory is one thing, new memories, but also skills are laying down new tracks, often with a part of the nervous system called myelin. So you make certain circuits much more communicative with each other. So you can lay down new circuitry for sure. That's new learning. But then there's a process called unlearning. Mm-hmm. And, for example, when you teach a pilot to fly an Airbus after she's been flying a 747, you know, you need to both teach her the new skill and unteach her. You have to unlearn the old skill because in an emergency, when it's really stressful, you will return to the old circuitry if it hasn't been unlearned. And Bob Bjork, B-J-O-R-K, he's got a whole systematic way. He's the person they hire when they train pilots like this to unlearn things. There's a great book called The Brain That Changes Itself by Norman Doidge. And in that book, Norman talks about the unlearning process and what it requires, and you know, some people feel it involves oxytocin that allows certain pathways to be changed. So I think we're just learning about literally the circuitry of it. And you know, in psychotherapy, of course, this is the ultimate question. Are we just teaching new things to get around old ways, or can we also unlearn, which means basically undoing some of those neural pathways? So it's open for discovery. It's a really interesting area and a very important question. So thank you very much.
Well, interesting. Thank you. Okay. Now we will hear a question from Ben. Go ahead, Ben. You have the mic.
Thank you. A number of us, well, first of all, this is just incredible exchange, and I knew nothing of your wording, which I just think is amazing, because I've tried to deal a lot with mindfulness, and the additions you have are amazing. A number of us have just come back from a science and non-duality conference called Beyond the Eye, the End of the Seeker, and in that we were exposed to all kinds of the stuff that you're talking about, and your framing would have been very, very helpful if anybody had used it. The other piece of this is that IONS is currently involved in the Worldview Literacy Program, I don't know if you're aware of that at all.
Tell me more. I don't think I am, but I might be and not know what the name of it is.
Kathy, would you tell them a little bit? Kathy? Is she there?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things that you talked about, Dan, was the application of what you're learning to education. And one of the programs that we are developing at IONS is called Worldview Literacy. Mm. And basically it is an educational program that right now is being pilot tested as a set of 15 curriculum modules that are each 50 minutes long and being dropped into high school and middle school programs where we teach kids basically initially that they have a perspective, they have a worldview, they have a filter through which they're seeing the world. And that everyone else does, too. You know, everyone else is viewing their world through a particular filter or a lens that has been determined by their genetics and their upbringing and their culture and their religion. And we use a lot of techniques to help kids not only know this but experience this for themselves, including optical illusions and sort of introducing them to things that they may not be seeing directly. And I know that you've been involved in some educational work as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question here is, I think...
I have a question coming up just based on this.
Yeah, go for it then.
Okay, thanks for that. And as an overview for this program, Matthew put together this. The Institute of Noetic Sciences recognizes that there are two truth systems in consciousness, two ways of acquiring information, the inner subjective, intuitive, the noetic, and the outer objective, intellectual, the sciences.
Mm-hmm.
Much of the world has focused on the latter in its educational and cultural development and ignored the former. As true experiencing of our natural wholeness as human beings requires that we integrate both the inner and the outer while recognizing the limitations of duality-based either-or points of view and the inclusive of non-duality based both and points of view. I'm wondering how that might fit in with your work.
It fits completely. I mean, it's such a, first of all, thanks for bringing it up, Ben, and, you know, Cassie, for summarizing it. You know, it fits completely with, you know, the framework of interpersonal neurobiology, which, you know, tries to do exactly that, teach about these perspectives and also embrace these ways of knowing. I mean, I think we would... embrace that and also build on it and say there's also a third realm of knowing, which is the intersubjective realm.
Yes.
The internal, the kind of objective, external, and then kind of an interpersonal, if you will, or whatever. So yeah, no, I think it's the same conversation with very similar wording, and I think it's one of the most important things we need to do in the world because it awakens people's minds to the profound way we're all interconnected. And if we do it from a scientific point of view, we can literally do what that sentence just said, which is embrace the equal validity, though the different quality, of inner knowing, intersubjective knowing, and external knowing. And that these are all, in many ways, just manifestations of energy and information flow wherever you are particularly looking at it at that moment. I mean, so from our point of view, from an interpersonal neurobiology point of view, we would say that MindSight would be what you're trying to teach there. You're trying to teach people that perspective that their own perceptual filters are shaped by genetics and experience and that there are many ways of knowing. And so I would say it's 100% compatible from what I heard. It sounds wonderful.
Wow, thank you. And my process is what I call the dots.
I'm sorry, that caused what, Ben?
Connecting the dots. In other words,
connecting the dots, yes.
Dealing with other people, but because they don't put things together like you have in your concept, they don't have a framing in which they can see how their dots might fit. Thank you very, very much.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the connecting the dots thing we use a triangle that has mind on one point, brain, meaning the embodied brain, on another, and relationships on another. So you have built into the triangle these different manifestations of energy and information flow. You know, the internal would be the mental, the intersubjective would be the relational, and the objectively measurable would be the embodied. And by always referring to this triangle, what's so exciting about it is you can then move deeply into any way of knowing, but see their interconnectedness, because they each influence the other.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. Thanks so much.
Okay, and now we're getting close to the top of the hour, so Cassie, we'll turn it back to you now.
Well, Dan, it's just been a pleasure to have you, as always, on the call, and I thank you so much for supporting the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and you've been such a strong supporter of my book, Mindful Motherhood, that integrates some of these concepts into the arena of parenting. And I'm just wondering if you have any final directions that you'd like listeners to go in terms of your book or your website.
Well, thank you, Cassie, and I want to thank IONS, too, for really honoring me with speaking to your community. You know, I think the only thing I would say is, you know, as you say, my website, the Dr. Dan Siegel, Dr. Dan Siegel, DanSiegel.com website, what we try to do there is really look deeply at the notion of, can you define the mind in a way that's useful and scientifically based? And then can you actually offer a definition of health, of integration, that has really practical implications? And in doing that, then, you're able to really look at the fact that we can empower people individually, in relationships, in schools, in communities, to create more health, more integration in their lives. And when we do that, ultimately we embrace the idea that we are all interconnected and that the ultimate outcome of integration is not only health, but it's resilience and it's kindness. And so what an opportunity we all have to work with each other to create a more compassionate world.
Well, thank you so much, Dan. And, you know, we're on exactly the same wavelength. And I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the call, and I'll look forward to your future work and future collaborations, and wish you a wonderful evening.
Thank you, Cassie. Thank you all for the wonderful questions, and I'll talk to you soon.
We hope you enjoyed this program from IONS. Located in Petaluma, California, the Institute of Noetic Sciences is a nonprofit membership organization that conducts scientific research into the potentials and powers of consciousness. To learn more about IONS, please visit us at www.noetic.org or call toll-free 877-769-4667.